Yeah,
top of lights. So you go to slideshow and then in the middle at the top, and then,
oh, yeah.
And then go to throb beginning at the other end. That's it, top of lights.
Great, thank you. So I should just say I'm losing my voice. So if by the end of this talk it's gone, I'm going to have to mime or something, do sort of spider things, which has actually happened before. So hopefully that won't happen. So I'm going to talk to you about some of the human uses of spider silk. And this interest developed from my own artwork. I use spider silk to make drawings and sculptures, and I also work with spiders in performances and videos. And from this interest, I started looking at the history of other humans who have used spider silk to make things. And as I was doing that, what I became interested in is not just the objects that were made, but more the process of making. And rather than considering making as something humans have as an idea in mind, which we then apply to a material, or as something that's just a cultural phenomenon. To understand the human uses of spider silk, I realized you had to think about the ecology of the spiders involved. You had to think about the cultural perception of spiders and spider silk, and this differs throughout the world. And you also had to think about the variability of the material of spider silk itself. So it's these three things that I was really interested in trying to pick apart or bring together. And what I'm trying to put forward is an idea of making as a process across species. So here are the main spiders involved in the story of humans using spider silk. Bearing in mind there are potentially over 40,000 species of spider, there aren't actually that many spiders that humans collect silk from. The key spiders are these first two. That's the European garden spider, which may be familiar to you. That tends to live in the northern hemisphere, and it makes a classic orb webs. The second is the Nephila genus, which tends to live in tropical regions, and it's also known as the golden orb spider because the colour of silk that it makes is a bright yellow gold. And finally, this is quite rarely used, is the wool crab spider, which exists in parts of Africa, and it's used in Central and West Africa to make the egg cases, which you can see there. The white patches are used to make vibrating membranes in musical instruments. But it's really the first two that tend to feature large in the story. So just to give you a rundown of what is spider silk. So spider silk is a protein, and the European garden spider can actually produce 7 different types of silk. So when we say spider silk, we're talking about a range of materials. And one of them is dry and tough. This is known as the dragline silk. And this is the one that people often refer to when they say stronger than steel and things like that. It's actually not stronger than steel, but it's far tougher. So that means that it's strong, but it also has capacity to stretch and withstand great impact, which you can imagine is necessary for a spider's web. Dragline silk is the thing that the spider always has behind it when it's wandering along, and it's also the silk that it uses to attach its web to trees and branches. There's also the sticky silk, which is actually made up of 2 different silks, and that creates the spiral. There's another silk that it uses to create its nests, another for its cocoons, and another to wrap its prey. So on top of all these uses, it also uses silk to communicate with other spiders, which some of you may have seen on a recent spider TV program, but they often communicate by plucking at each other's webs, generally the male courting the female. But the female communicates to the male by laying down pheromones in her silk. So bearing in mind that I'm focusing on the human uses, there's also a huge number of other things going on in exactly the same material. Now, silk is produced by the spider, not by kind of pulling it from its body like Spider-Man, but by pulling it from its spinnerets. And it can do this either by actually pulling it with its legs out of its spinnerets, or it can fix it to a point and walk away, or it can just stick the back of its abdomen into the air, and a passing breeze will take the silk and it can float off into another environment. And certainly in the spring, a very exciting moment for spider enthusiasts is when the little spiderlings that have just been hatched will do this, and it's called ballooning, and it's a way of getting away from their siblings so that they don't get eaten. So the ways that humans have collected spider silk are generally two different ways. They either collect the whole web, or they will do exactly what the spider does and pull silk directly from the spider's spinnerets. An important thing to bear in mind is it's only female spiders whose silk has been collected. And we could maybe talk about why that might be, but one of the obvious reasons is that the female spiders are larger than the males. Males produce silk as well, and the webs that they make are larger and more visible. Okay, so briefly, some of the human uses, which I won't be focusing on today, but up here is actually a video still from one of my pieces of work where I created a spider silk choker, which I attached to a spider's web, and I sung for the spider. You can just see a little European garden spider up there, and she responded by either running at me or she plucked her web trying to sense the vibrations, and I was able to record the sound of her plucking her web, so we had a very romantic duet together. Down here is a drawing of a mysterious instrument called a Nias Durango, which apparently was made in northern India, and similar to the vibrating membranes that I showed you earlier, these were placed inside these little trumpets, and the player would sort of do some throat singing, and the vibrations would pass through the egg cases. On the sides here, we've got a use that's been prevalent for the last 300 years, which is that if you look at any either microscope, telescope, or gun sight pre-1950, those lines that you see are probably going to be made of spider silk. They're spider lines, they're the drag line of the European garden spider. So this is inside a telescope eyepiece here. You can see these lines which will be moved in relation to whatever star was being measured. And these you can see is the spider aiding the big kill. Here is spider silk used for fishing lures. This is used in parts of the South Pacific. And this is to catch needlefish that have very long, spiky mouths, and they're becoming entangled in the spider web. And finally, this is just a ridiculous photo of two men looking at a goat's bottom, which is a spider goat, which, again, some of you may have heard of. This is I'm using to represent attempts to make synthetic spider silk, which is being funded mainly by biomedical and military industries to create a versatile material that can either be used to grow tendons or can be used to create extraordinary planes which withstand attacks. I should say that this has not been achieved. Synthetic spider silk has never been made, and indeed for various reasons probably never will. But one attempt which the goat represents is to cross the spider's silk-producing gene. They've crossed it with the goat's milk-producing gene, and they milk the goat, and spider silk comes out in the milk. They extract it from the milk. It's not a single thread which they then weave. Okay, so the two examples that I'll be focusing on today are weaving with spider silk and layering spider silk. And the first example, which is a woven cape made entirely from the silk of the Madagascan golden orb spider, and that colour is its natural colour. And that went on display in 2012 at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and was made by Simon Pears, an English textile manufacturer, with his American business partner, Nicholas Godley. And it was the culmination of an 8-year project to try and weave with spider silk. Simon Pears owns a Malagasy textile weaving business in the capital. The second example that I'll be talking about is layering with spider silk. And this photograph is from the 1930s, taken by an anthropologist, Bernard Deacon, who was in Malekula, which is an island in the nation of Vanuatu in the South Pacific. And it's only in this very small region that this use of spider silk occurs, and it's by layering on top of each other many, many layers of spider web. But the important thing is that both these examples use the same genus of spider. They both use the golden orb spider. So I'm just going to grab some water. So shimmering weaves. Here's the golden cape on display at the Victoria and Albert Museum in a glass case. And Simon Pierce talks about the desire to make this as a desire to fix the ephemeral. He said he wanted to capture these webs that otherwise would be dispersed in the wind and make it into an object that would last forever. And it was very much an object to be looked at rather than worn. Very few people got to touch this object. There was the model that I showed you before. A couple of models got to wear it. They had to stand very, very still. And obviously Simon Pierce and the makers got to touch it. But nobody else could either wear it or feel it. I did meet Simon Pierce and he showed me a little bit of the thread. And what's extraordinary about spider silk, especially when it's been twisted, is although it's incredibly bright gold, if you close your eyes and touch it, it's as if there's nothing there. It feels of nothing. Simon Pierce was inspired to attempt to do this by coming across the history of spider silk weaving in Madagascar. And at the turn of the century, so towards the end of the 19th century, the French colonial government in Madagascar decided that to show the wonders of their colonies, they would set up a spider farm in Madagascar. And that's what you see here is women on the Madagascan spider farm. And their job is to look after the spiders that live on these canes and then take them indoors, collect their silk and weave with it. And the result of this was this set of bed hangings. This is the only illustration. Which was shown at the 1900 Paris Exposition as a way of showing the glory of the colonies. And these were apparently these golden bed hangings. They disappeared soon after. And this is a story that happens again and again. People say, we made an entire suit of spider silk, and there's no evidence of it. So in fact, there's very, very few examples of existent woven spider silk fabric. There are a few examples in Lyon, And apart from the cape, that's all that exists. Further back, we've got Guy Termier, who was a Jesuit priest, who realized that you could extract silk directly from the spider. So this is one of his machines that he made. He would trap the spider so that it couldn't cut the thread with its legs and pull the silk from its body. And then down there in the corner is my version of a description of a guy called Daniel Rolt, who lived in London towards the end of the 19th century, and he decided to attach a garden spider to a steam engine that he'd borrowed from the factory in which he worked, which he then wove into a little piece of cloth. But the thing that ties all of these interests together is they all talk about the glow of the spider web, of being struck by the beauty of the colour. And it's very much an attempt to retain this glow, which interests them, and also to create a silk industry that would compete with that of the Asian silk market. So again and again, you see this desire, and then followed by a realization that it's very difficult to harvest silk from spiders. So to go back to the woven cape, the way they made it is that they collected silk from over 1 million Nephila spiders. Every morning, 60 to 80 people would go out into the area around the factory, collect these spiders, take them back to the spidery, where they would be put in harnesses, 24 individual harnesses. And this was so that their legs would be strapped down, so they couldn't cut the silk with their back legs, and the silk would be extracted from their spinnerets and twisted together for up to 25 minutes. They'd then be taken back outside, and the new spiders would be put in the harness. And there's no image of the spiders in the harness. And this, I don't know if you saw the exhibition at the V&A, but it was a very visible thing. It was in all the papers, it was very well advertised, but this actual moment of the spiders being harnessed, there's no record of it. So although the cape itself is embroidered with images of spiders, you also notice there are changes in colour in the cape itself. In areas it's very, very bright gold, in other areas it's more silvery, and there are also touches of pink. And these changes in colour are actually due to the environment in which these spiders in their harnesses were having their silk extracted. In very bright sunlight, golden orb spiders create bright golden threads. In slightly shadier days, they create much more silvery colours. So what you're seeing in the cape is also this sort of weather map of the entire process in which these spiders were having their silk extracted. And these tiny dots of pink, I asked Simon Piers about, and he said that during the summer it was very hot and the embroiderers were getting sweaty hands, and somehow the sweat on their hands mixed with whatever chemicals are in the silk and turned them pink. So you have this whole other story of making which can be seen in the cape and is slightly disguised by the embroideries of spiders on it. So here is a close-up of the cape with the spiders that Simon Pierce designed to be embroidered onto it. And one of the problems he has is that the magic of the object is that it's spider silk. He wants to retain this golden glow, and to weave with it he can only use this dry dragline silk. But looking at the cape, there's no evidence that it's made of spider silk. So to make it clear that it's magical and made of spider silk, he has to stick images of spiders back onto it. So moving on to the second example of sticky layers. They don't have quite the same problem of us having to put images of spider silk on it, because as you can see from these layered fabrics, it's actually got all the stickiness on it. It's got bits of flies. If we zoom in there, you can see that there are bits of beetles, flies, dust, whatever the stickiness is collected. And what's great is it can still stick more to it. So getting it out of the museum, you've also got accumulation, the capacity to grow in the object. And this is a smothering hood. It's called a smothering hood, held at the Science Museum in London. And here's the information that goes with it. So this was written when it entered the museum in the late 1930s. And it's entirely fictitious. It's not a smothering hood. It was not used to smother widows. This never took place in this region of Vanuatu. And we find similar misidentifications with other hoods from the region. So here is one in Pitt Rivers. This is a cap of death. And then over here, these are from the British Museum. These are slightly more whimsical. This is a nightcap, which you really wouldn't need in Vanuatu. And the other one is a smoking cap, apparently. So what we're seeing here is generally Western explorers finding these objects, realizing they're made of spider web, thinking, oh God, that must be to do with something horrific. It's probably to do with widow strangling. They are, in fact, tied to the cycle of life and death, but in a very different way to how these have been identified. So just in case you don't know, that's where Vanuatu is. Malekula is one of the islands in the nation of Vanuatu, and in the southwest of Malekula, is where the silk is, the spider fabric is made. Now, Malekula, there are 20,000 people living there, but there are 35 languages. I mean, the diversity is extraordinary. But it also means you've got cultural diversity within that. So This is this area, there's no tradition of loom weaving. The way fabrics are made tend to be bark cloth layering. So there's a history of making fabrics through layering rather than weaving. And in this region, they've chosen to do that through spiders' webs. And here's how they collect the web. This is a bamboo cane that's been split into pieces, which every morning the men go out into the jungles. And when the spiders have freshly made their webs, they swipe these incredibly large and very, very strong webs out of the trees, and they build up onto each other, tie them off, and you have a cone shape. And these hoods are actually worn by men of very high rank of the grading systems within this region, and the higher up the grades you go, the longer the hoods get. And they get handed down through generations as well. Now, in this region, although gold exists as a metal, it's not valued. And what is valued about these particular spiders' webs is not the colour, it's in fact the spiders themselves and the cycle of life and death that they exhibit in both their capture of prey, but also in the way that they eat their webs each night and build a new one each morning. So to just return to the image, it's a slightly different image of this man dressed entirely in a spiderweb tunic. As the men in this region go higher up the grade system, they become closer to what's called the living dead man. They become closer to their ancestors. And rather than being like the cutting of the thread of life, as we have in the classical story of the Fates, in this area, life and death are seen as completely enmeshed. And actually, when you die, you meet the spider spirit. If you can pass the spider spirit labyrinth, which in itself is a sort of woven line, then you can return to the world of the living. So there's no strict division between life and death in the same way as the cloth that's made has this sort of depth to it. And importantly also with this image, in comparison to the cape, where you have a model standing very, very still and no one's allowed to touch it, these are cloths that are worn to be danced in. So you can see at this is an old image, but he's in the middle of performing in a funeral. And you can see the kind of leaves blowing behind it. It's a moment in a dance that Bernard Deacon has captured. So here we have, it's not so much about the idea of fixing the ephemeral, but it's more about the capacity to accumulate and of life in death. So in conclusion, back to the spider, there are two points I want to make about attempting to look at making as a process across species. The first is the importance of being specific. The spiders I've talked about, it's not just that they differ in terms of species, the materials also differ in terms of what they've eaten, the environment they're in, and even their age. So it's important not to think of it as either a human-animal generalization. It's more interesting to kind of see what happens where you look at differences within and across species. The second is the importance to focus on the process of making rather than in the material. And this not only implicates human actions, but also helps us to think about the ways in which things humans cannot access or are not part of also feed into processes of making, and that is spider making. Thank you.
Questions. Just turn this off if I may.